morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program happens to be on the 215th anniversary of Lewis and Clark beginning their epic trek on June 13th, 1804, across the North American continent to what is now the oldest city in the Yankee Doodle West, Astoria, Oregon. But the program is not about that. Today's particular trek across the radiosonic frequency sphere begins with two college professors, starting with Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, followed by Portland State University History Professor Emeritus David A. Horowitz. We start with Dr. Brake. Theater of War. As I reflect on D-Day 1944, I am reminded of a 1968 book, The Lessons of History, in which historian Will Durant calculated that there had only been 29 years in all of human history to 1968, during which a war was not underway somewhere. Since 1776, we Americans have experienced just 20 years without involvement in a war, and we have lionized great warriors and endured painful memories from the enticing elixir of war. I'm convinced that a reading of ancient plays can be a catalyst for our discussions about the challenges faced by our servicemen and women, veterans, their families, caretakers, and their communities. For example, Sophocles wrote his play Ajax 2,500 years ago, during a century of war and plague. Ajax is the wrenching story of the formidable Greek warrior Ajax, cousin of Achilles, betrayed and humiliated by his own generals, exhausted by war, undone by violence and pride and fate and hopelessness. Until at last, seeing no way forward, he takes his own life during the eighth year of the Trojan War. Ajax was known as the Shield, a warrior who did everything necessary to fight fiercely to protect his troops. Like other Greek troops, Ajax believed that crying is for women and cowards, and that real men never show their emotions, beliefs still harbored today as saber-rattling politicians drumbeat for a war with Iran. Through tragedy, the great Athenian poets and playwrights were not articulating a pessimistic or fatalistic view of human experience, nor were they bent on filling audiences with despair. They were giving voice to timeless human experiences of suffering and grief that fostered compassion, understanding, and a deeply felt interconnection. Ajax is about loss, loneliness, and post-traumatic stress. Sophocles himself was a general, and his audiences were undoubtedly citizen soldiers, and the performers, most likely, were veterans. Ancient Greek drama about war was an elaborate ritual aimed at helping combat veterans return to civilian life after a century that saw 80 years of war. Plays like Sophocles' Ajax read like a textbook description of today's wounded warriors struggling under the weight of psychological and physical injuries to maintain their dignity, identity, and honor. Think about America's current wars. We have been at war for 18 years. Soldiers have sometimes been deployed for 1,000 days or more, 4 or 5 tours in Afghanistan or Iraq or both. For many troops, the stresses have been unbearable, leading to extremely high rates of suicide. Current troops about to deploy need an experience that speaks to their inner fears, needs, and struggles. Hence, the significance of productions of Sophocles' Ajax, sans lights, costumes, sets, or musical enhancement that help many veterans heal. Productions of Ajax around the country have helped boost morale as veterans tune in to the compelling story of a warrior struggling with the wounds of war. It's clear that psychological injury, that we now call PTSD was a persistent issue for warriors 2,500 years ago. Like Americans today, ancient Greek soldiers experienced the violence of war on and off the battlefield. In Afghanistan, the United States has waged war for 18 years, the longest war in our history. Never before have so many American combat veterans returned to a country in which so few Americans have been touched by the war in any meaningful way. So how can we reintegrate our soldiers and ourselves into a healthier society? It would help to keep the conversation going and to understand the importance of what I call kitchen sink realism. Maybe that's what Sophocles knew, that Ajax suffered and spoke for all of us so that we too might suffer and speak. No one is invulnerable to the invisible wounds of war. That's the core message of Ajax, an expression of new grief and fresh loss, as near and familiar as our own voice. And another by Dr. Brake, Lysistrata Revisited. After the 25-man Alabama Senate passed America's most restrictive anti-abortion bill on May 14th, actress Alyssa Milano suggested that women should withhold sexual privileges from men. She echoed Greek comic playwright Aristophanes, who composed Lysistrata in 411 BC. Lysistrata, an exceptional woman with mercy and humanity on her side, sought to force men to end the calamitous Peloponnesian War, which was 431 to 404 BC. It lasted that long. Fast forward to saber-rattling Republicans, currently hinting at a war with Iran and the ongoing, quote, war to dismantle Roe versus Wade. Perhaps our obsession with wars might promote some women to reconsider Lysistrata's war. I suspect that Alabama women may not take up arms against their menfolk, withholding sexual privileges. But whenever men make stupid decisions about women's private parts and a woman's right to have control over her own body, it becomes necessary to cut through the media clutter to raise awareness. In 2003, Liberian peace activist Lema Gbowee, I hope I'm saying that correctly, it's spelled LeymahGbowee, earned a Nobel Peace Prize for her protests that included a sex strike to end her country's civil war. She acknowledged that it had little or no effect, but did attract significant media attention. Actress Milano's proposal probably won't be taken seriously, but she did attract my attention. I recall that Milano was featured in the 1980s ABC hit sitcom called Who's the Boss? Intriguing title. And I recall that in the ancient Greek theater, all the actors were male. Women were not allowed on stage because that was considered dangerous. Fascinating. And that was Dr. Robert Brake with Lysistrata Revisited, which I just badly read, and Theater of War. And now, the second college professor, PSU, Portland State University, History Professor Emeritus David A. Horowitz, who will give a keynote speech to PSU history grads tomorrow night, which was inspired by Lillian Hellman's Watch on the Rhine from 1943. This is what David wrote and plans to say. I have had the fortune to work in a department that has extended me the freedom to follow my passions and left me pretty much to my own devices. I have also been inspired by the openness and the willingness to explore new ideas among the vast majority of the thousands of students I have encountered since 1968. Having said that, the discipline of history is fraught with contradiction. Our profession took form in this country in the late 19th century as an avenue for Eastern Anglo-Protestant elites to train public statesmen and cultural guardians in the interests of instilling civic pride, social deference, and national loyalty among the emerging business class and among industrial workers. Under the impact of two 20th century world wars followed by the campaign against global communism, prominent historians willingly served the state's priorities. At the same time, the advent of mass higher education in a consumer economy compelled academic institutions to conform to market priorities and student desires for social mobility. This leaves the humanities in a quandary. Whether it be from state subsidies, private philanthropy, or student tuition, most of our financial support comes from those with utilitarian expectations. Yet just about all of us who teach history have a broader concept of our mission. Although everyone might put it in their own way, our calling arguably involves the desire to use historical perspective to expand the centrality of reason and empathy in human affairs. I realize that family members or loved ones of our graduates might wonder if this is enough to justify the sacrifices often asked of you. Perhaps you might take some comfort in the thought that anyone fortified with reason and empathy may not only thrive in family and personal relationships, but aspire to becoming a successful individual in whatever pursuit they choose to follow. Yet there is a larger dimension to the work we do related to the world we inhabit. At its best, the global interconnectivity of the Internet and social media have presented enticing possibilities for engaging far-flung social challenges. How else would we have learned of the World Bank report last fall that 1 billion people across the globe have escaped extreme poverty in the past 30 years? Although substantially higher rates of destitution persist in sub-Saharan Africa, the bank heralds this decline as one of the greatest achievements of our time. I wish we heard more hopeful news like this in academic circles. At the same time, there is no denying that ominous political and cultural developments are shadowing the world from Eurasia and the United Kingdom to the United States, South Pacific, and beyond. The current heart of darkness, so to speak, appears to lie in a revival of the virulent tribal nationalism that in the 1930s preceded a global bloodletting that extinguished the lives of more than 70 million human beings. History does not repeat itself, Mark Twain is reputed to have remarked, but it does rhyme. I worry how well we are preparing students to deal with a world in which empirical inquiry, rational thought, and mutual tolerance are under assault. Whether originating in the highest circles of power or on social media sites that function as entertainment for their followers, the potential for violent outbursts emerging from such discourse is exceedingly perilous. This is no time for happy talk. These dangers call for mental toughness, spiritual clarity, and strategic discipline. My fear is that many of our students come to us imagining a bipolar universe. On one side are virtuous actors of pure motive who represent groups bound by ties of historical deprivation, culture, ethnicity, gender, or lifestyle. On the other lies a phalanx of performers imbued with hostile ideologies that never have changed through time. The problem is that once people find themselves in the self-contained bubbles of their chosen affinity, they can fail to evaluate their own group's actions in strategic terms nor comprehend the possible limitations of its appeal to others. On the other hand, the inability to grapple with the historical or social context contributing to their rivals' emergence makes it difficult to respond to their provocations. For example, how much of authoritarian lashing out stems from resentment of the perceived cultural power of cosmopolitan, middle-class professionals and academics? To To carry the bipolar metaphor further, well-intentioned people confronted with mindsets and behavior outside their frame of reference may react in two ways. The first involves a retreat to despair, depression, and fear, as if nothing can ever repair the damage the adversary has wrought. The second evokes a manic response to social pathology that insists that the only path forward lies in the most visionary programs that empower like-minded cohorts, whatever their political feasibility. I think you can see where I'm going. Both reactions risk empowering the forces advocates hope to discourage. Studying history does not provide any blueprint of social activism, but it does offer constructive hints. These include the need for humility as opposed to moral arrogance, and the necessity of calm self-confidence, not intimidated by the words or even actions of others. It includes a willingness to compromise one's objectives, frame them to the interests and sensibility of broader communities, and participate in wide-ranging coalitions. It often means, as the great anti-slavery abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison once noted, that although substantive changes are invariably addressed as immediate concerns, they will all be gradual or incremental in the end. "I will take better every time," Barack Obama told a Howard University commencement in 2016. Better is good, because you consolidate your gains, and then you move on to the next fight from a stronger position. "We all go up, or we all go down," Franklin Delano Roosevelt instructed the nation at his second inaugural in 1937. I love studying and teaching history because it provides the opportunity to change the way I think about things. In fact, nothing seems more liberating to the human mind and spirit than the chance to keep learning and gain the ability to reframe one's views, even if core values remain the same. I hope we are helping students strengthen the ability to carry on the work of nurturing the human condition and binding up the world's wounds, to paraphrase Abraham Lincoln. But for all of us to do so, I believe, we must learn to think strategically beyond the boundaries of our own sentiments and affinities. The stakes may be quite severe, but perhaps with the aid of historical perspective, we can somehow manage. And that was David A. Horowitz from a speech he is going to make at the Portland State History Awards Ceremony tomorrow night, June 14th, 2019. And David has taught history at Portland State for 50 years and continues to do so. And now, a poem by David's brother, Michael Horowitz, aka Z.O. Blum, who wrote this poem 30 years ago in the aftermath of the June 1989 massacre at Tiananmen Square. In tribute, The Goddess of Liberty by Z.O. Blum, aka Michael Horowitz. There she was in the square, lifting her torch above the crowd, leading scholars against tyranny. Her frozen likeness guards New York, but she was last seen in action in the streets of Paris in the uprising of 1830 and immortalized by Delacroix, liberty guiding the people. Our romance was in Mexico in the late 1930s, where Rosa had gone to help Cardenas. But the news was bad. Guernica, Munich, and she began drinking at noon. I left the morning she confused me with Trotsky. Yet I never worried about her. When your politics are as good as hers, angels pay your rent. It was good to see you, Rosa, raising hell in China. And that was in tribute, The Goddess of Liberty, by V.O. Blum, aka Michael Horowitz, who, writing under his nom de Blum, is the author of many books, among them Equator, Sunbelt Stories, Split Creek, and Down Mind, a psycho-experimental novel, and the immortal Freaks Anthology. He has also written for The Nation magazine and taught humanities and social science at universities in New Zealand and Tonga in the Pacific Ocean. And Michael, again, wrote this poem in tribute to the appearance 30 years ago of the Goddess of Liberty at Tiananmen Square during mass demonstrations against the Chinese Communist government in the spring of 1989. The Goddess of Liberty was a large homemade sculpture in imitation of a Statue of Liberty and was carried by demonstrating members of the Chinese Student Democracy Movement, which organized the protests that spread for weeks throughout China in hundreds of cities and involved millions of Chinese dissenting against government tyranny and corruption. On the night of June 3rd and the next day, June 4th, the Chinese People's Liberation Army was ordered to disperse the demonstrators at Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Soldiers and tanks opened fire and killed thousands throughout the night. Many thousands more were wounded or injured. Several thousands more were arrested, many of whom simply disappeared. Thousands of others fled China afterward. Nicholas Kristof, a New York Times columnist, originally from Yamhill, Oregon, was at Tiananmen Square amidst the slaughter. He has written that Chinese propaganda has scrubbed history of the democracy demonstrations and massacre these past 30 years. Yet Chinese continue to quote the writer Liu Zhong after an earlier massacre. Lies written in ink cannot disguise facts written in blood. Astoria photographer Jim Stoffer was also at Tiananmen Square just before the massacre. And now, Abortion 101, something I have written and previously read on this program. A new civil war? Probably unconscious of the ramifications of his words, a man who claimed leadership of the anti-abortion crusade at abortion clinics once compared political decisions that transfer the right of abortion from women to the state to the Dred Scott decision of 1857. He said rulings to gut but preserve the facade of the 1973 abortion law, Roe versus Wade, were analogous to Dred Scott, which was a major factor that precipitated the Civil War. Scott, a slave, sued the U.S. Supreme Court for his freedom. Slave owners and their political and judicial cronies insisted the court reject Scott's claim of citizenship because he was a slave, which meant he was hardly human. Abolitionists attempted to convince the court that all persons were human beings and entitled to citizenship and freedom. Chief Justice Roger Taney declared that the original intent of the Constitution favored only the freedom and citizenship of white males. The general consensus among the founding fathers and long afterward, he said, was that Negroes were, quote, so far inferior that they had no rights that a white man was bound to respect, unquote. The net effect of the Dred Scott decision was to make the issue of slavery too explosive for political or judicial settlement. It was later termed a monumental indiscretion and a public calamity. Justice Felix Frankfurter once remarked that Supreme Court justices never mentioned Dred Scott after the Civil War any more, he said, than a family whose son had been hanged mentioned ropes or scaffolds. The abortion rights issue in the United States follows the same unfortunate premise. Women are not regarded as equal citizens. They do not have the right to make elemental choices about abortion. The hypocrisy is that women have had to make these decisions for thousands of years. Women have been responsible for birth control or forced to be the instruments of euthanasia in regards to unwanted children in the vacuum left by irresponsible men. Abortion at least allows a woman to dispose of a surplus child before it is born. Men who abdicate the responsibility for birth control yet believe they should control a woman's options, which has less to do with concern for the unborn fetus than it does retaining supremacy over women. Women are not allowed to be free and equal citizens. For that matter, 154 years after emancipation, neither are black people who wish to be known as Afro-Americans in recognition of their long presence in this hemisphere. Humanity is crowding itself off its home planet. Abortion is a survival mechanism that attempts, consciously or subliminally, to alleviate the ever-increasing ravage of the earth and the specter of incessant poverty and starvation by an overabundant species that seldom practices successful birth control. In the bad old days, children were abandoned or slaughtered when a population overran its resources. Abortion is a more preferable option than an AIDS or Ebola epidemic in stabilizing growth. Warfare only amplifies the calamity. Frenzied post-war breeding generally expands a populace beyond pre-war numbers. Yet, as with slavery, abortion causes furious arguments and is such an emotional issue that a civil war of sorts is in the process of erupting. Like the infamous Three-Fifths Compromise that allowed that much but no more consideration of slaves being human, the Trump administration and its allies on the religious and male supremacist right have declared that women are so far inferior they have no rights a man is bound to respect, quote unquote. This brand new Congress has a chance to take back the ground for women's rights to abortion and equality of citizenship and gender that the Trumpites have misappropriated. And that was something I wrote and have read on the air more than once, but it seems to be topical every damn time I read it. And this is Michael McCusker. On June 15, 1846, 173 years ago, the USA and Great Britain signed the Oregon Treaty, which established the 49th parallel as the international boundary with Canada. And tomorrow, 100 years later, on June 14, 1946, Donald Trump was born. A 73rd birthday gift idea by all great patriotic Americans, might be great all-American cheeseburgers presented at the White House in a reimagining of that loathsome TV commercial, I Want It All and I Want It Now, by a multitude of multi-ethnic minimum wage slave fast food service rabble. Winston Churchill seemed to anticipate Trump when he once said, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on. And next Wednesday, June 19th, is National Juneteenth Day, which essentially commemorates the freedom of black slaves at the end of the Civil War in 1865 and the end of slavery in the USA, celebrated as Black Liberation Day, equivalent in its significance to the 4th of July. Anne Frank was born 90 years ago yesterday, on June 12, 1929. And, hoping to avoid irony, happy Father's Day this Sunday night.